Hello and welcome. So today's presentation is going to be on prevalence of brain injuries and those involved in the justice system. And today's presentation is brought to you by the Brain Injury Association of Maryland. Before we get into today's presentation, I do want to take some time to introduce myself. My name is Nadja Burton. I am one of the support service case managers for the Brain Injury Association of Maryland for the Brain Injury Waiver, and I am the health educator for the Brain Injury Association of Maryland. And for those who do not know, the Brain Injury Association of Maryland is a nonprofit organization that sources information of brain injury resources. And the mission, our mission at the Brain Injury Association of Maryland is to be the voice of those who are affected by brain injury through advocacy, education, and research. And we strive to bring health, hope, and healing to thousands of Marylanders living with brain injuries, their families, and professionals who serve them. Okay. So to start off today's presentation, I want to open up with a statistic or this quote that says that in a recent study, found that 60% of those in the criminal justice system within the criminal justice system involvement has a TBI. So 60%, so that's over half. So for today's presentation or today's discussion, I will be going over the TBI fingerprint and what that exactly means, the changes after a brain injury. So we'll dive deep into physical changes, cognitive changes, and behavioral changes growing into a brain injury and what that exactly means and how it ties into today's discussion, TBI and substance use, again, how that also ties into today's discussion, then prisoners with TBI, addressing TBIs in prisons and after release, and some resources. So the TBI and ABI fingerprint. So before we actually go into what the TBI fingerprint is, I really wanted to take this quick detour and talk about the skull anatomy. So on the screen, I have a picture kind of the base of the skull. And the base of the skull has these ridges more in the front and the side of the base of the skull. And those are where your frontal and temporal lobe lies. And these ridges can increase the chances of sustaining a brain injury in these areas, the frontal and temporal lobe of the brain. So hopefully that gives you a little insight of what the TBI or the fingerprint of brain injury. So the frontal and temporal lobe are critical involvement in managing your behavior and emotions. And these lobes, again, like I mentioned, because of those bone ridges found in the front and the side of the brain where the frontal and temporal lobes are located, there are increased chances of getting damage. And when these lobes are damaged, they are considered the fingerprint of traumatic brain injury. So each of these lobes, they have their own, how do I describe these? Functions, there we go. They have their own kind of functions for each of these lobes. So as I mentioned, the frontal lobe is located in the front of your brain. So it's right behind your forehead. It's one of the biggest lobes in the brain, and it has, I will say, the most important job, if you ask me. So the executive, one of the functionings of the frontal lobe is your executive functioning skills. And the best way for me to describe the executive functioning skills, it's kind of like the parent, your parenting skills. It helps you with your working memory, your flexible thinking, your self-control, your planning, your organizing. It also helps with your problem solving, your judgment, as stated on the screen. So this executive functioning skills helps you think and manage moving throughout your environment safely and successfully. And some other things that the frontal lobe helps with, it helps with controlling your emotional responses, your expressive language, assigning words, word association, understanding abstract concepts, reasoning, flexible thinking, as I mentioned before. So your temporal lobe is located on the side of your brain, right above like your ear area. So again, where those bone ridges are located. And even if you press right here on the side of your head, you can kind of see how soft you can press in a little bit more compared to like the front of your head. So again, this is another area where, or another sign or contribute of why the temporal lobe has an increased chance of getting injured, because the skull is just the thinnest right there. Like again, I say if you just press right there, it's more the temporal lobes are more vulnerable, I should say, of being damaged. And so on the screen, it mentions that the temporal lobe is really responsible for your hearing, storing information in your short-term and long-term memory. But there has been studies that associates a study that involved violent individuals, and they kind of looked at their temporal lobe and sees that there was some epilepsy, and that suggests that there was some dysfunctioning in their temporal lobe and that structure in their temporal lobe that could lead to increased aggression and hostile and violent behaviors. All right. So we've been talking, or I have been talking about TBI and traumatic brain injury. You might be thinking, like, what exactly does that mean? So there are different types of brain injury. There's an acquired brain injury and a traumatic brain injury. So there are two, those definitions are on the screen. But before I go into those two definitions, I want to give you the broader definition. So this is where it might get a little confusing. So an acquired brain injury is a brain injury that you acquire after birth. So it's just the broad definition of a brain injury or acquired brain injury. And so that acquired brain injury can be broken down to non-traumatic, which is often referred to as an acquired brain injury, or traumatic brain injury. So the definition of acquired brain injury that's on the screen is the non-traumatic definition. So an acquired brain injury or a non-traumatic brain injury is is defined as an insult to the brain that occurs after birth caused by internal factors. And those examples of those acquired brain injury or non-traumatic brain injuries are stroke, aneurysm, lack of oxygen, so hypoxic or anoxic brain injuries, tumors. Those are examples of acquired non-traumatic brain injury. And then traumatic brain injury is defined as an insult to the brain caused by external physical force. So examples of those causes of traumatic brain injuries are falls, car accidents, sports injuries, assaults. So just so you know those definitions. So we have an exercise, and it says what it might feel to be living with a brain injury. I'm sorry, excuse me. Before I go into this exercise, excuse me. Yes, before I go into this exercise, I do want to state that even though the question is posed as what it might feel like living with a brain injury, this exercise is not saying this is exactly what it feels like. It's not saying this is how exactly what it feels like to have a disability. So if you feel like this is not inappropriate, or you you wish not to participate in this activity, feel free to fast forward. But again, this is just to help someone who is new to this topic and might want to gain a little bit of an understanding of maybe the frustrations, or just again, gain some little bit more of an insight or understanding of brain injury specifically. So let's get into today's exercise. So for this exercise, you will need a paper and a pen. So I'll let you grab a paper and pen really quick. So I'm gonna take a sip of my water while you do that. All right, hopefully you have your pen and paper. So once you grab your pen and paper, grab your pen or pencil with your dominant hand, and I just want you to just quickly sign your name. So if you, depending on your age, you have been signing your name for years, and it doesn't really take that much mental or physical, like it's not an exhausting task to you. Hopefully, again, if you're doing this for years, it's almost automatic. Next step, I want you to switch the pen from your dominant hand to your non-dominant hand and then sign. So I'll let you do that. It's probably take you a little bit longer. You're probably struggling, probably not breaking a sweat just as yet, but it's a little bit harder because it's something that you're not used to doing. Okay. And then we have the third step is, and the final part of this exercise. So you still have your pen or pencil in your non-dominant hand. I want you now to lift your right foot a few inches off of the ground and move your foot counterclockwise. This is counterclockwise to me. So while you have your pen and pencil in your non-dominant hand, moving your right foot counterclockwise, I want you to roll your tongue in your, no, we won't do that one. Just move your foot counterclockwise. Now let's try to sign your name with your non-dominant hand. I'll give you a quick moment. You can imagine someone, while you're doing this task, someone's saying, come on, what's wrong with you? Like, you've done this many times. I don't understand why you're taking so long. Like, hurry up. Like, come on, chop, chop. Come on. Really? Really? I can imagine that you're getting a little frustrated, flustered, maybe you're anxious, maybe you're maybe breaking a sweat. So again, this is not exactly what an individual who has a brain injury feels like, but this is just giving you an exercise to kind of give you an insight, like what are the situations of or the feelings that someone may be feeling when they are just trying to do a task that they are used to doing before their brain injury, and now they have their brain injury, and that's how it feels, like just an idea, an insight. All right, so Excuse me. Hopefully that gives you a little eye-opener that having the changes after a brain injury of having that mental, you have to actually think about doing this task is something that used to take like that before. Now you actually have to think of the steps, take your time, and then you have maybe something else going on physically or another distraction while you're trying to execute these activities. It can be a little straining or difficult or frustrating. So let's actually go into some of the physical, cognitive, and behavioral / emotional changes that have to happen after a brain injury. So on the screen, I have some common and less common physical changes that happen after a brain injury. So after a brain injury, it's very common for someone to experience headache, fatigue, weakness, dizziness, having trouble sleeping, or having fatigue, dizziness, changes in their balance, changes in the sensory, so vision, smell, touch, taste. Their speech could be slowed, it could be slurred, their coordination could be changed. But some of the less common changes are changes that we see are these physical changes that we see, they happen in individuals who have more of those moderate or severe brain injury. I don't think I talk about the severity of brain injuries in this presentation, but if you head over to our Brain Injury 101 presentation, we talk about the severity and how that is. What are the signs and symptoms that we look for to diagnose the severity of a brain injury? But back to these less common physical changes. So we have hemiparesis and hemiplegia, and those are that's when the muscle is weak. There's muscle weakness or partial paralysis, and it's usually found on one side of the body and usually affects one's arms, legs, and facial muscles. Then we have spasticity, and this is when limbs become stiff and weak and the range of motion in the limbs become limited. And again, this often affects one side of the body than the other. And then we have apraxia, and this is when an individual often understands what to do and usually have the physical abilities to complete the task. However, their body has trouble coordinating or cooperating to the individual's best intentions. So some cognitive changes that can happen after a brain injury. So executive functioning skills, it should sound a little familiar. This is your skills that are usually associated with your frontal lobe. So when you have a brain injury, your executive functioning skills could be diminished or diminished or impaired. So again, your attention, concentration, your processing, your problem solving, these things could be diminished when you have a brain injury. And then confabulation. This is often can come off as lying, telling stories. However, this is a neurogenetic. So confabulation, again, like I said, can come off as making up stories or lying, but it's actually the way the brain is trying to fill in gaps when it's been trying to cover or, recover from the brain injury. So the individual might have some gaps in their memory, but maybe they're coming in and out of consciousness while they have these gaps. And so their brain is trying to make sense of what's happening in their environment. So they might fill in, make up stories to fill in these gaps. Again, in our brain injury 101, we talk a little bit more about confabulation, so you can go to that presentation to gain a little bit more introspection on our understanding on that cognitive change after a brain injury. And then we have persistent and preservation. And this is when an individual unable to move on to another topic, even though the other person in the conversation has moved on to the other topic, somehow they find a way to return back to the topic over and over again, and they are having a hard time breaking this cycle. So some behavioral changes that happen after a brain injury, we have emotional liability. And this is more of a very extreme or severe mood swing. So the difference with this is how fast the emotions change and the extreme of the emotions compared to your quote unquote normal mood swing. Anxiety is another behavioral change that happens after a brain injury. This could be because of the brain injury itself. So they might be suffering from PTSD. And with PTSD, it's a traumatic event for the individual. It does not have to be a traumatic event to you or another individual. So if someone falls down the stairs, that is a traumatic, and that's the reason why they sustained the brain injury. That could be it. That's a traumatic event for that individual. So hence, maybe falls, maybe stairs can trigger them, and they become anxious, which caused them to that cycle. But for other people, stairs are not that traumatic, but it's traumatic for that individual. So please be aware of that. And then also it could be changes in their daily routine, and with, especially if it interferes with their rehabilitation. So that could cause some anxiety. And then aggression, with the frontal lobe being so big, it's prone to being injured. And brain injury, and with that frontal lobe helping with your executive functioning skills, your that self-control that has that braking mechanism. So things that you were able to take a deep breath and saying, it's not that serious, I can walk away. With someone with a brain injury, they don't have that braking mechanism to say, let me hold it together and walk away. They're going to probably react to these things that cause them to be aggressive, that cause them to fly off the wall or fly off the handle. And it's very common, loved ones and family members usually say that they're family member who sustained a brain injury, they do become short fused, fly off the handle after their brain injury. So here are some, before we go into our next topic, I just want to share these statistics with you. In 2016, based off a parental report, 8.3% of boys and 5.6% of girls between the age of 3 and 17 have had a significant head injury in their lifetime. And as age increased, the percentage of children who have ever had a significant brain injury also increases, peaking at 11.7 among children between the age of 15 and 17. Well, to say all of that, we're going to go into growing into a brain injury. And you might be thinking, don't you mean growing with a brain injury? No, I don't. I mean growing into a brain injury. And the reason why is because in children with brain injury, they have a structured environment, should have a structured environment where they have a parent that helps with, you know, their executive functioning skills, or they have other tools, whether that's counseling, school counseling, school's personalized plan to help them with their executive functioning skills, maybe things that cause them frustration at schools to help them cope with that. However, when children start aging into their teen years or even aging out of school where they have less structure, then the brain injury kind of amassed themselves because of those structures that was there before that was helping them move throughout their environment, move through school successfully. They're not there anymore. And that helped with the brain injury. And so that brain injury didn't seem like it didn't max itself. It didn't seem present. But when the structures went away, now all these, maybe the cognitive and behavioral changes that were mentioned before, they're starting to come to light. They are unmasked as those structures fall away. And there have been studies that follow children with brain injury into adolescence and young adulthood that found that they are more vulnerable to develop substance use related disorder and become involved in the criminal justice system. And that's what is on the screen right here. And so what are some possible risk factors for children to sustain a brain injury? This could be their age. So young children who sustain a brain injury could be, hopefully you can hear me again. So one risk factor could be their age. So if young children learning to walk, they're more risk of falling, and that kind of ties into the socioeconomic status. So again, with a child learning how to fall, maybe they don't have a lot of preventative measures like baby gates or safe place to play. So that could also increase the chances of falls and again, knee down the stairs, sustaining a brain injury. Also another factor of age is adolescence, whether they are in car accidents or maybe sports injuries. Again, the impact sports. And there have been numbers, studies showing that the incidence of brain injury has more than doubled for athletes under the age of 19 for impact sports. All right, so more stats. So on the screen, we have that 10 to 20% of individuals who have a TBI develop a substance use problem from the first time they have injured. Then we have up to 50% of people who are receiving substance use disorder services have a history of TBI. And then as many as 60% of people who require inpatient rehabilitation after a brain injury have a history of substance use. So let's briefly go over brain injury and substance use. So with brain injury and substance use, there is a strong correlation between substance use and brain injury. And one of them could be that the substance use could cause or contribute to someone sustaining a brain injury. And one of those brain injuries would be the hypnoxic or anoxic brain injury. So one example of a substance is opioids, which depress your respiratory system to the point where it's distressed or arrest. So there could be limited oxygen or a lack of oxygen getting to your brain, causing hypnoxic brain injury. Or there could be a total arrest, so no oxygen getting to the brain, causing anoxic brain injury. And with those sudden loss of oxygen getting to the brain, it has greater effects on the brains that use high oxygens or such as the frontal lobe. And again, the frontal lobe helps with those executive functioning skills. So planning, organizing, and those skills help someone with their social and vocational, so getting and sustaining a job, could these things could be impaired. Just to say that. So the US Department of Justice has reported that 50% of women and 41% of male offenders were under the influence of drugs and alcohol, or both, during their time of arrest. And studies of inmates self-report of health incidents that inmates with one or more head injury have a significant higher level of alcohol and drug use during the year preceding their current incarceration. And although more than half of prisoners and inmates that have a lifetime history of drug use disorder, fewer than 15% receive substance use treatment services while in prison. So TBI within the justice system. So before we get into to a video that I have on the next screen, I wanted just to go into some facts. So women inmates who are convicted of a violent crime are more likely to have sustained a pre-crime traumatic brain injury and or some other physical abuse. Inmates with head injury often have seizure or mental health problems such as anxiety, suicidal thoughts, or attempts. And correctional personnel, law enforcement officers are at risk for head injuries or fatal head trauma. So the law officers may have these behavioral issues that I mentioned before, such as aggression as well. So all these incarcerations with suspicions of prior arrests with inmates during their incarceration are considered high risk of situation for their injuries or death due to head traumas. So let's get into this video. So it's about, I'm just going to show 4 minutes of this video as stated on the screen. So let me play this. Oh, perfect.
A concussion can occur even without blacking out or losing consciousness and may not appear on brain scans. These symptoms, such as headaches, nausea, blurry vision, dizziness, fluctuating mood, sleep disturbances, or foggy slowdown thinking, can occur because the brain is working harder to recover affected cells. Though many people recover fully from a concussion, if you experience any signs or symptoms as a result of hitting your head or strong external forces, take notice and seek treatment if symptoms worsen. We will now bring together what we have discussed about the brain and changes after a brain injury with specific scenarios. We will suggest strategies to help foster positive interaction with these individuals who have a brain injury in the community.
911, what is your emergency?
Hi, I was just involved in an accident. I accidentally hit another vehicle, and now he's screaming at me, banging his fist against my car, and I'm really afraid to get out of my vehicle.
Stay in your car, ma'am, and officers will be out to your location right away. Is he threatening your life, or does he have any weapons that you can see?
No, he's just sort of yelling loudly, but he hasn't threatened me.
What are you waiting
Hey,
for? Yo, look at my
okay.
car. Look
It's
at my car,
already
yo. Get out this car.
freaking out.
Get out this car. Get out
No,
this car.
look at
Hey,
me.
step away.
Sam,
step away from the car.
Hey,
step away. Look
what?
At me.
What?
Look at me.
What? What?
Step
can't
away.
You see my car? What can you
Keep that
my car?
Cane on the ground.
I don't care.
Lower your voice.
No,
I
Not that car, man. Can't
listen,
you understand?
You need to lower your voice and listen to me, and you
what?
Keep that cane on the ground.
I need this cane, yo.
And you need to break away from her.
No,
I will work it out for you. You
no,
need
you
to calm
work.
Down.
When interacting with a person with brain injury, a commanding presence and exclusion of family members can considerably deter rapport building. A display of aggression or negative behaviors could potentially further escalate by turning it toward the officers or leading to harm of oneself or others. Let's see how the situation would differ if the officers take a more calming tone, tactically communicating with the family and individuals from a distance, maintaining attention and building rapport.
Look at my car. Yo, look at my car. Yo, come on now. Come on, get out the car right now. Because I'm paying for this.
What are you doing?
What?
Okay, sir.
What?
Officer Mack with the
Relic. I don't care who you are.
Yell at me. That's fine. Okay.
Man, look at my car, y'all. I just got that car, man.
Can you tell me your name, sir?
John. My name's John. But, yo, it don't matter right now. All I care about is my car. You know, that bitch can't see.
I understand.
She's
just
driving all over the place.
Okay, Officer Mack, we just need to calm down just a little. Okay.
Well, I can
just relax.
Man,
we're gonna work this out for you. It's okay. Just relax. All right. First of all, are you okay? Were you injured?
I'm all right, but my car. Look at my car.
Okay. How about your wife?
Yeah, she's all right.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
And then I'm gonna have to talk to this young woman too. Okay.
I don't care about her.
Everything out. I do though.
She's in my car.
That'll be my
she
help.
My car. Yeah,
John, I'm gonna work all this out. John, you could just look at me.
Man, what
John,
you smile for?
John,
okay,
just relax. Okay, would it be okay if we just kind of walk over here?
Yeah, it's all good.
All right,
good.
Come on, let's just walk over here.
Ooh,
we're gonna be all right.
We're
gonna work it all out for you. I promise.
Often, individuals may be triggered, or unexpected situations may arise, potentially leading to escalated behaviors. Use of restraining, such as the back.
Okay, so that clip just showed some examples or techniques to de-escalate a situation or interactions with an individual you might think that has a brain injury. Okay, so we are now going to talk about addressing TBIs within the system. So the next few slides are really targeted for individuals who work within the system and how to talk about some management skills or de-escalation skills, as mentioned. So first, attention deficit. So individuals who have a brain injury or have recorded some type of head injury, their attention may be difficult and they're focused on their tasks that require them to focus in response to correction officer. This could also be interpreted and leading to the impression of being deliberate or defiant in part of the inmate. So let me rephrase this or say this again. So with the attention deficit, so an individual who has attention deficit, they might have a hard time focusing on certain tasks or tasks that require them to focus, and that these directions are coming from their correction officers, but they're having a hard time focusing, paying attention, and this may come off or be misinterpreted by the correction officer of them being defiant. So here are some management strategies or some suggestions to these correctional officers when they have reports of working with individuals who have a head injury or brain injury. You want to ask the inmate to repeat what they said to confirm that he or she understands what the directions are. You want to encourage the inmate to write down the steps for the task. You want to allow extra times for the task to be done and clear or reduce any environmental distractions. So for memory deficits, this could be also be interpreted as with these memory deficits, it could be difficult for the inmate to understand and remember rules and direction, which can lead to some disciplinary actions from correction officers. So again, some strategies to help with that, to explain the rules and directions slow, step by step. You want to need to repeat the steps to encourage, to make sure that they understand the rules. You want to also encourage them to write down these tools. And also you can ask them to give some examples so on their own, see if they also understand these rules. And then for slow and verbal responses, again, with these slow and verbal responses, this could also be interpreted as being uncooperative, but however you want to ask the individual who has sustained a brain injury questions, giving directions. Again, you want to give them slowly and repeat them as necessary. And you want to give that inmate additional time to respond. So for any irritability or anger for this inmate, this kid, because of their irritability or anger or their lack of controlling their irritability and anger, this can lead to incidents with other inmates or correction officers. So things that you want to do to help reduce or eliminate those situations is to avoid arguing with the inmates, try to rephrase problems and breaking down down into chunks or more consumable chunks, and reinforce positive behaviors. And with impulse behaviors, which can include unacceptable sexual behaviors, this again could provoke inmates, resulting in disciplinary actions by jail or prison staff. So you, again, the management skills is to tell the inmate in a calm, interview manner that their behavior is unacceptable. And you want to seek mental health professionals if it continues or increases. So some key takeaways when talking with someone who has sustained a brain injury in the video, it might not seem as hidden because the individual had a cane, he had some other physical disabilities, but for most parts, a brain injury can be invisible. So it could be really hard to realize that someone may have sustained a brain injury. So you want to ask the best way that you can support that individual. You want to avoid those arguments, avoid quizzing. Instead of, you want to offer up memory cues, and again, be patient. Okay, so addressing the problem. So, there has been a recent report in the Commission of Safety and Abuse in Americans in America's prison, and it's recommended to increase health screening, evaluation, and treatments for inmates, and develop a partnership with community health providers to assure the continuing of care and case management for release for inmates. In addition, TBI experts and some prison officers or officials have suggested the following: routine screen for jail and prison population to identify a history of TBI, screen inmates with a TBI for possible alcohol and substance use and provide treatments for co-occurring conditions, and conduct additional evaluations to identify specific TBI-related problems and determine how they should be managed. Special attention should be given to impulsive behavior, including violence, sexual activity, and suicide risk for inmates with depression. So some screening tools, there are some screening tools for some of those co-occurring diagnoses, but there are some screening tools for brain injuries. Excuse me. So before we go into some screening tools, I just want to quickly talk about what is a screening tool and what is an assessment and why they differ. So a screening tool, let me go to assessment. So assessment is a process to define the nature of a problem or diagnosis to determine the diagnosis. You want to develop a specific treatment plan, recommendation to address the problem or diagnosis. So there are some examples for assessments for brain injury. So we have the Mayo Portland and the agitated behavioral scale. So those are some assessments that are used for specifically for individuals with brain injury. So with screening tool, it's just an evaluation to give out the possible presence of a particular problem, diagnosis, and the outcome is usually just a yes or no. And it has been discussed recently that the no shouldn't really be a no, it should be more like yes and then a maybe. Yes. Or maybe, a yes or a maybe. It shouldn't just be a no. So when you have the screening tools, and if there is that definite presence or maybe a presence, you want to then move on to the appropriate assessment. So those are the two, and usually assessment is done by a professional who has that history or training to complete the assessment, and the screening tool can be done by pretty much anyone. You just go through their questionnaire. So here are some examples of some screening tools for brain injury. Yes, so the two that we'll be talking about are HELPS and the OSU-TBI. So on the next screen, I actually have some examples of these screening tools and what they actually look like. And the HELPS is a brief 5-minute questionnaire. And as you see, there's yes and no's. And then you have some rooms to write down your comments if there are any. And this one does account for TBI, but they also ask for some questions about possible ABI or acquired brain injury or the non-traumatic brain injury. So with the last one, it's talking about sickness after you hit your head. So again, that's kind of alluding to a possible acquired brain injury. So the OSU or the Ohio State University TBI questionnaire, this one is a standardized one and it kind of goes over the lifetime of the the person's lifetime history and the possible of them sustaining a brain injury. And this one takes about 3 to 5 minutes, just depending on the individual. And there are three steps as you see on the screen, and then they just give you more spaces below each of the, they just give you a little bit more room to actually write down any additional comments on this questionnaire. And it also looks at loss of consciousness, how old, how long you've lost consciousness. So it goes a little bit deeper into the traumatic brain injury component, but so those are some examples of screening tools. There's more screening tools out there. They're just not these two. So you can go ahead, do your research and find out which appropriate screening tool is right for you or your organization. So we have another quote. There's one study that shows that the recidivism rate, so the rate of returning back into the justice system, is nearly 70%. That's way over half percent. over half or 50%, way over half of people with TBI are twice the general recidivism rate. Over half. So addressing TBIs after release. So what can be done? So there's a lack of treatment and rehabilitation for inmates with mental health substance use problems while incarcerated, increasing the probability that they will use again once they are released. And the presence of substance use can lead to homelessness, returning to illegal drug activities, and being rearrested, increasing their risk of death after release as a result of the criminal justice professionals, TBI expert that have suggested the following. That community reentry staff should be trained to identify the history of the TBI that have access to appropriate consultation with professionals with the expertise in TBI. Transition services should be capable of accommodating the effects of inmates' TBI upon their release and return into the community. And release inmates with mental health or substance use problems should receive case management service to address or assist with placement into community treatment programs. So we have some key takeaways. So some things that I think are important that you should really take away from this presentation, that children who have sustained a brain injury at a young age may be able to recover physically after their accident. However, without the proper support, brain injury can lead them to have mental health and addiction issues that bring people with living with a hidden TBI into the criminal justice system. Alcohol and other drug use is strongly associated with risk-taking, increasing your chances of involvement of criminal justice, getting involved in the criminal justice system. And TBI are common in the criminal justice system and should be accommodated. So there are some community resources or literature that are out here, that you can access. So the Brain Injury Association, as mentioned at the beginning of the presentation, is a, we host and store a lot of information about brain injury and some community resources that do tailor towards brain injury. So there are also the health issue in correctional settings. And there's a website that provides information of public health and criminal justice system professionals about health topics. Then there's the imminent partner violence. And this site is for professional and the general public about intimate partner violence. There's the legal issues of persons with TBI within the correctional setting, the National Disability Rights Network, and this site provides information about laws protecting the civil and human rights for persons with disabilities, including TBI. And there is the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. And this site provides information about treatment resources for persons with or at risk for mental or substance use problems. So again, my name is Nadja Britton, and I am one of the support service case manager and health educator for the Brain Injury Association of Maryland. I want to say thank you for your time. And if you have any questions about today's presentation or would like more information, you can email me or our organization at info@biamd.org. And the phone number that you see on the screen is to our office, 410-448-2924. All right, thank you.